Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening today. Coming up later this hour, a history of the 20th century as seen through Pantone color schemes. That's the theme of a new book, and we have put on our website, taking some panels from that book, a Name That Decade color scheme quiz on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You will see certain kinds of palettes and see if you can figure out which decades those colors tended to be popular in. Go check out the Name That Decade color scheme quiz at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And then later on, we'll have Keith Recker, co-author of the book, Pantone, the 20th Century in Color. But right now, today is World AIDS Day, December 1st. There are many ways we could acknowledge it. This has been a very striking year in the history of the AIDS epidemic, including the first time an HIV-positive human being has apparently been completely cured, virus-free. The magazine PAWS, P-O-Z, as an HIV-positive, has a great retrospective of the year in an article called The PAWS 100, 100 People, Things, and Ideas We Love, and it begins with the idea that treatment for HIV doubles as prevention. With us now is Regan Hoffman, editor-in-chief of PAWS magazine. Thanks so much for coming on WNYC on World AIDS Day. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
What does that phrase mean, treatment doubles as prevention?
Well, you know, it's the ultimate killing two birds with one stone, or actually saving a person's life and saving exponential lives in the same moment. People who are living with HIV who take antiretroviral therapy have a reduced risk of transmission that is 96%. So it is an enormous barrier to the prevention of the spread of the virus. So we not only keep people alive, but we stop the disease from spreading around the world. This is an unprecedented discovery, and it gives us, quite frankly, the justification to come up with the funding and to solve the barriers to care that are keeping almost 850,000 Americans and about 27, almost 28 million people around the world from the pills that will save their lives.
In other words, if somebody who's HIV positive and is taking the antiretrovirals has sex with somebody who's not HIV positive, the chances of spreading the virus are lower than if they were not on the treatment.
Absolutely true. And, you know, I want to make a point here that to achieve that risk reduction, a person must have very, very good treatment adherence. So they must have they must be virally suppressed. And viral suppression comes when people take their pills every day and they are on a regimen that they are not resistant to. So it's not just that you take the pills, but also that your virus is suppressed to an undetectable level. And when that is true, yes, indeed, you are much, much less infectious.
So you don't want people to get complacent, right?
Correct. No. And I can tell you, as someone who's taken pills for every day of my life for 16 years, it's not an easy thing to remember to do. But when it's going to save my life and other people's lives, it's that much easier.
So you note in the PAWS 100 that in light of that finding, the UN increased its goal to 15 million people on medication by 2015.
Yes.
How many people are on medication today? Is it known?
Yes, it's around 6 million globally. Now, remember, we've got about 34 million people around the world with HIV, and only 6 million are in care today, so that's about 17%. But what happened today was absolutely amazing. The President of the United States, President Barack Obama, just pledged to put 6 million in care by 2013 via PEPFAR, which would bring the global total up considerably, closer to around 8 million by 2013. So we're really looking at an enormous jump up, and we're going to do that, by the way, not with necessarily additional funds at this particular moment, but by strategically reallocating some of our resources. You know, now that we know that treatment doubles as prevention, it makes a lot of sense to put a lot of the funds that we have into expanded access to care. But, you know, Brian, think about it. With only 6 million or 8 million or 15 million, that's still less than half. And, of course, every day people still continue to get infected. So the way we really end AIDS is twofold. We really have to have universal, true universal access to care as quickly as possible, which means bringing the cost of the drugs down and getting them to more people, and then eventually curing it. You know, we really don't want people on pills for the rest of their lives if we can help it.
Well, you mentioned a cure, and obviously this is the year, and we did a separate segment on the show earlier in the year about Timothy Brown, the man who was cured of AIDS.
Yeah.
So let's revisit that story. Oddly enough, it was partly because he also had leukemia that he was able to be made HIV free, right?
Indeed, yes. He had AML, which was a different and rare form of leukemia, and a German doctor, the patient is an American, Timothy's an American, but the German doctor who tried to treat him for his leukemia had the brilliant idea of doing the stem cell transplant with cells that were actually immune impervious to HIV. So when they rebuilt his immune system, they did so with cells that were resistant to the virus, and he has been declared 3 years after the initial treatment HIV free. In fact, he was at PAWS magazine yesterday. I shared pickles with him. We had lunch, and he came to the magazine. And I have to tell you, I had interviewed him. He was on our cover last summer. And to be a woman who was diagnosed in 1996 and to be alive 16 years later, to open the door of PAWS magazine and watch Timothy Brown, the first man cured of AIDS, walk through that door, I just about passed out.
Maybe he should be Time's Man of the Year.
He does. We need to have him on the cover of Time.
And obviously, a stem cell transplant, I know someone who had one, is an extremely extreme medical procedure and fraught with risk of death and other horrible complications.
Yes.
Not for everyone who tests PAWS.
No.
So does Timothy Brown's experience hold any implication for something on a larger scale regarding a cure?
Well, indeed, and what the scientists learned from what happened in his body has led to some really exciting scientific breakthroughs. Obviously, we're not going to be able to to repeat his modality of treatment and cure in a large number of people or even a handful of people. It's very hard to find donors, and as you said, you almost die from this disease or from the treatment, excuse me. So, no, but what we established with Timothy's case was a proof of concept, and that has led researchers to really, really hunt for a way to replicate that process with perhaps gene therapy, altering the cells that are in the body so that those existing cells can then be immune to HIV. I'm on the board of AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, and a lot of the research that we're funding right now is pursuing exactly that. How do we take what happened in Timothy and replicate it and make it available to a wide number of people?
We're talking with Regan Hoffman, editor-in-chief of PAWS magazine, on the PAWS 100 for 2011, 100 people, things, and ideas we love on this World AIDS Day. 212-433-WNYC if you want to join the conversation. 212-433-9692. Number 9 on the PAWS 100 is more controversial. The AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, you cite, which grew out of ACT UP. But in addition to advocating vaccine research, they promote other preventive measures like male circumcision and female barriers. Is the AIDS community firmly on the side of circumcision as a scientifically proven risk reducer?
Well, it's an excellent question, and quite frankly, I was surprised when I asked that question, were adult men lining up to be circumcised? And the answer is, quite frankly, in many countries where that is their only option for reduction of transmission, the answer is yes. In fact, in Africa, where our PEPFAR programs are doing a lot of work, men will line up and get circumcised because of the risk reduction for themselves and for their partners. So it is absolutely, it is a harm reduction strategy. It does not, of course, prevent the transmission of HIV entirely, but it is proving very effective.
So in the ongoing debate in some circles over whether circumcision is a form of mutilation, whether it itself is cruel, HIV prevention is a factor that needs to be discussed.
It is. And remember, we're not talking genital mutilation of women. We're talking removing the foreskin from an adult male penis, which apparently sounds awful to me, but is apparently a safe and relatively harmless procedure. Ideally, we would, I think, like to have other methods, but it is working. So it is definitely something that we need to continue to discuss.
And which cervical barriers are most of interest to the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition?
Well, we're talking about biomedical prevention. Unfortunately, we just had some disappointing news out of a new microbicide trial this week. And what we're looking to do, Brian, is put medications, the same medications that control HIV, into gels and lubricants and substances that people would then insert into their bodies and have the topical presence of the medications become a barrier to HIV transmission. In fact, you know, that's still a science that needs some work. But ideally, this is an option for perhaps, you know, women and men in places where condom use is not an option or they're not empowered to be able to advocate for condom use. It allows you to, you know, protect yourself and take the control into your own hands. So in a perfect world, we have every option available to people. People make different choices about how they have sex and who they have sex with and what their risk factors, what risk factors they are comfortable with. So we want to make sure that we are addressing all of the prevention needs of all of the different scenarios out there in the world. So I hope that we keep, you know, looking for a functional microbicide.
And as we talk about prevention, what about the place of vaccine research? Hasn't there been a longstanding argument that vaccine research is the wrong place to devote a lot of attention because it's expensive and a long shot and money might be better spent on people who are sick today?
Yeah, you know, it's no easy choice. We have, you know, looking at how we divvy up the available pie, and hopefully that pie continues to grow because we have the opportunity to end AIDS. And if there was ever a time to inject a bolus of new funding, whether that is in cure or vaccine research or in terms of being able to expand access to care, this is it. I mean, the more we do of all three things, the faster we're going to get this sucker off the face of the earth. And the science is so promising on all fronts, quite frankly. While vaccine has been challenging, it's often been true in history that developing vaccines for anything, whether polio or other conditions, is in fact a time-consuming and challenging proposition. But in the end, often we do solve the problem. So I don't think we should give up on vaccine research. A vaccine is part of the matrix, but I think it is about looking at priorities and strategically applying the funding where we're going to see the biggest return on investment as quickly as possible and save the most number of lives with whatever resources we have.
We mentioned Timothy Brown. Number 84 on your list is Sangamo Medical Sciences, which is researching a more broad-based cure with a technology they call zinc fingers. What's that?
Well, zinc fingers, it's sort of hard to explain, but they're literally like little tiny scissors that part, you know, can cut out part of the genetic makeup of a cell that then alters the cell so that it is impervious to HIV. So basically, this is what we were talking about before. If you were able to replicate what happened in Timothy Brown's body without taking away his immune system and basically giving him a new one, which is the thing that almost kills people, but rather taking the existing immune system and sending in these little zinc fingers to snip out parts of the DNA so that that immune system that exists in a person's body is altered to the point where it can resist HIV.
How far along is that research?
Well, you know, some of the people who are working on this say we're very close. It's working in mice. We did in our cure story this summer, we've talked to several scientists who are really on the brink of looking at human trials. The bottom line is people are a bit risk adverse. I think we've had a long history of maybe false starts with AIDS science, and we really have a new era right now and an opportunity. If I were an investor, not just in science and not just in AIDS, but in anything in the world, this is where I would put my money, because this is not just going to help people. This is going to change the future of humanity, and this is going to rewrite one of the worst tragedies of all time and turn it into a real success story. And, you know, the U.S. has led the way. Our U.S.-funded research and the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, that has been supported by both a bipartisan Congress and also the administration, has done truly extraordinary work around the world, and we can repeat it here at home, of course.
And this is perhaps a new era, as you say. One of the things on your list is that you say this is the year where the media, as well as the scientific community, started to talk in a serious way about the end of AIDS.
Yeah. I mean, I'm here at George Washington University in D.C. this morning. We just heard the president speak, and we heard President Bush via satellite from Tanzania and President Clinton via satellite, and Bono's here, and they're all saying the same thing. Tony Fauci, Eric Goosby, everybody is saying the exact same thing. We can end AIDS. The question is not can we, but of course will we. Will we find the resources? Will we find the political capital? Will we find the drive and the determination from the activist community to come together and lobby for what we need?
But until that time, there are still controversies. So the PAS 100, number 13, Edwin Bernard, founder of an HIV anti-criminalization network, and he wants to decriminalize non-disclosure, exposure, and non-intentional transmission. Where are these things criminal?
All over the world, unfortunately, there's been a trend, and this is reflective of the stigma that surrounds HIV, Brian. You know, the laws that exist currently in many countries, including the United States, already serve to protect people from the very rare case of someone trying to harm someone else with HIV. What has been happening is, you know, nothing short of hysteria around this disease based on misunderstanding, where juries and the legal system are trying to convict people who are living with HIV of allegedly exposing others to the virus. You know, it's a very unfortunate situation, because what it serves to do, people think that if they criminalize people with HIV, it will protect the public from them. But of course, the opposite is true. It drives people underground. It prevents people from wanting to get tested. It really demonizes the disease. And that makes it harder to fight, harder to treat, harder to prevent. And of course, all those things make people more at risk in general. So it's an unnecessary and terrible trend that can be corrected. And actually, we are seeing some courts begin to get it. In fact, there was a case recently that we reported on in PAWS where a judge decided that HIV was not a death sentence, not an automatic death sentence anymore, which is true. It's not. So we're beginning to see the tide turn a little bit, but we still have a lot of work to do in that arena. And as you mentioned, Edwin Bernard is a wonderful, wonderful leader and activist in trying to correct this issue.
When he talks about decriminalizing non-disclosure, though, what does that mean? Shouldn't a person with AIDS or HIV be required to disclose before having sexual contact with somebody, let's say?
Yes, it's my personal belief, and this is my personal belief, that, you know, yes, you should tell your partners if you're living with HIV. You should also tell your partners if you're living with hepatitis or herpes or HPV. But we don't criminalize people for those things if they don't disclose them. So I think it's, you know, we need a consistency across disease states if we're going to condemn certain people. First of all, we shouldn't condemn anybody. But there's also a responsibility on the partner. I mean, I contracted HIV, and I consider it my responsibility in part because I chose not to have protected sex. Now, that other person could have disclosed or could not have disclosed, but I played a role in that. You know, they could, in my case, he didn't know that he had HIV. So, you know, you really, as a person who's having sex out there in the world or sharing injection drug equipment, you must be responsible for your own health and safety. And no matter what people tell you or not tell you, you can make choices to protect yourself.
One last thing, the PAWS magazine itself this year, you guys sponsored a new iPhone and Android phone app called I Stay Healthy. Want to mention your app before you go?
Yeah, thanks. It's great. It's a way for people to track their CD4 counts and labs and also the pills that they're taking. So, you know, part of successful treatment, which doubles as prevention, is being adherent and taking your pills as prescribed all the time. And it's a wonderful application that we have just signed up to, and we're proud to be part of it.
Regan Huffman, editor-in-chief of PAWS magazine. They are out for this World AIDS Day, December 1st, 2011. With the PAWS 100, 100 people, things, and ideas we love. It's been really, really interesting. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Brian. And I hope all your guests will go out and get tested today. Go to PAWS.com, POZ.com, and take a test.
Okay. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a tent city grows in Lakewood in New Jersey, where the town and the county provide no homeless shelters. We'll talk to somebody living in that tent city. How long can it go on? And a history of the 20th century as seen through Pantone color schemes. Stay with us.